see him shoot a glare at Father Tyler. The Avarth is sacrosanct. 7 empty floors, Your Holiness, she pressed on. Think how many displaced people you could house and feed.
There is no extra space in the Avarth, Majesty.
In return, Kelsey continued as though he had not spoken, I would be willing to consider all of the church's new London property as charitable, and forgive the tax on those landholdings.
Only New London.
The Holy Father burst out laughing, an unexpected sound from his mirthless face.
New London constitutes only a tiny fraction of our property, Majesty. Now, if you were willing to throw in our holdings in the Northern Almont, there might be an arrangement to make.
Ah, yes. Your farmlands, where the poor work for pennies a day, and their children start in the fields at the age of 5.
Charitable property indeed. These people would otherwise have no employment at all.
Kelsey stared at him. And that allows you to sleep at night?
I sleep well enough, Majesty.
I'm sure you do.
Majesty.
Father Tyler stood up abruptly, his face panic-stricken. I must use the restroom. Excuse me.
Somewhere during the argument, Mila had slid a dessert plate in front of Kelsey. Cheesecake dotted with strawberries. Kelsey made quick work of it. It wasn't one of Mila's best efforts, but there really was no bad cheesecake, and even Kelsey's temper was not enough to blunt her appetite. Mace gave her a pleading glance, but Kelsey shook her head. While she chewed, she cast surreptitious glances at her guards, wondering for whom that remark about homosexuality had been meant. Perhaps, like so many things in God's church, the Holy Father had simply produced it from thin air. But Kelsey didn't think so. It was too odd a claim. And was it any of her business anyway? According to Carlin, the institutionalized homophobia of the pre-crossing had wasted vast amounts of time and resources. Barty, with characteristic practicality, always said that God had better things to worry about than what happened between the sheets.
No, Kelsey decided, it's not my business.
She wished she could simply tell the Holy Father to go fuck himself. It would feel wonderful. But where would she house all of those remaining refugees if not in the Avarth?
Bedding, sanitation, medical care. Without the church, it would be a disaster.
Briefly, Kelsey considered threatening to seize the Avarth itself under eminent domain, just as she had threatened that group of idiot nobles a few weeks ago. But no, that would be a disastrous move. A direct attack on the Avarth would only confirm every dire warning the Holy Father's people recounted in the pulpit, and too many people believed the church's nonsense.
The Holy Father had been trying to make her angry, Kelsey realized now, and he had succeeded. Anger made Kelsey strong, but it weakened her as well. She saw no route to wend her way back into negotiation now, not without losing ground.
"I think His Holiness and I have provided enough entertainment for one evening," she announced, standing up.
"Shall we move on to the real performance?" The Holy Father smiled, though the smile did not meet his eyes. He hadn't touched his cheesecake either, and Kelsey cast her mind back, trying to remember if he'd eaten anything at all. Was he worried about poison?
Surely this man would not scruple at making one of his acolytes taste the food.
"You're wondering. Focus on the Avarth, the Mort." Kelsey tried, but she didn't see what could be done to repair the situation now. And wasn't this all academic anyway? The Mort would be here long before the new tax year, and New London would never stand up to a prolonged siege. Debating next year's taxes was like painting a house that lay right in the path of a hurricane. Perhaps she should just relent. But at the mere thought of it, Kelsey's mind conjured the Avarth steeple. Pure gold, worth many thousands of pounds. She could not give in. As the group moved toward the throne, Father Tyler reappeared beside Kelsey, speaking in a low voice.
Lady, I beg you not to antagonize him further.
He can take care of himself. But Kelsey paused, seeing anew the priest's pale face, the weight that had dropped from his already thin frame. What is it you're frightened of, Father?
Father Tyler shook his head stubbornly.
Nothing, Majesty. My concern is for you.
Well, if it's any consolation, I do plan to be on my best behavior for the rest of the night.
And yet that plan so often fails.
Kelsey laughed, clapping him on the back. Tyler's grimace became more pronounced and she bit her lip. She had forgotten that she wasn't supposed to touch a member of God's church.
Sorry, Father.
He shrugged, then grinned mischievously. A rare occurrence for Father Tyler.
It's fine, lady. Unlike His Holiness, I'm not concerned about your wanton sexuality.
Kelsey chuckled and gestured for him to come with her to the top of the dais, where two armchairs had been set up. The Holy Father was already seated, and he gave Kelsey one of those disturbingly bland smiles as she sat down. His acolytes remained standing at the foot of the dais. Mace gestured for Elston to stay with them. So Mace, too, was worried about the tall acolyte with the weasel's face. Memory tugged at Kelsey for a moment before letting go. Mace snapped his fingers at the magician, Bradshaw, who came forward and made a shallow bow. He didn't wear the brightly colored clothing Kelsey had seen on so many street performers. Rather, he was dressed very simply in black. A table had been set up nearby to hold his props, an assortment of objects including two small cabinets placed perhaps 2 feet apart. Bradshaw opened the cabinets, lifted each to show that there was no false bottom, then took a cup from the dinner table and placed it in one cabinet, shutting the door tightly. When he opened the door of the other cabinet, the cup was there. Kelsey clapped, pleased, though she had no idea how the trick was done. Not magic, surely, but it had the appearance of magic, and that was good enough. Bradshaw made a quick succession of objects appear in each cabinet. One of Dyer's gloves, a bowl from the table, two daggers, and finally, Mace's mace. This last caught Mace out with a bewildered expression that turned momentarily to anger, then back to bewilderment, as Bradshaw took the mace from the cabinet and presented it to him with a smile. Kelsey clacked loudly. Few people could put one over on Mace, and even fewer would have dared to try. Mace inspected his favorite weapon for a moment, as a jeweler would inspect diamonds, and finally appeared to conclude that it was indeed the same mace. In a low voice, Kelsey told Elston to give the magician a 50% tip. The Holy Father was clearly unimpressed. He had watched the entire performance with an increasingly sour expression and had not clapped once.
Not a fan of illusions, Your Holiness?
Not really, Majesty. All magicians are con artists, deceiving the common people into belief in pagan magic.
Kelsey nearly rolled her eyes, but stopped herself. Her window of opportunity was closing here. Once the Holy Father walked out the door, he was never coming back. And perhaps he would be more amenable to reason now, when there were fewer people to overhear. Bradshaw was waving his hands in a performative fashion below. Kelsey waited until he produced a mouse from nowhere, before asking quietly,
"What would tempt you to accept my offer?"
"Perhaps we could reach a compromise, Majesty. Forgive the taxes on both our new London holdings and half of our acreage in the Almont, and the church will happily feed and house 4 floors worth of the displaced."
Kelsey looked up at Mace.
"How much tax money is that?"
"Only Arliss would know for certain, lady. But you're talking at least 1,000 square miles of producing farmland. A year's taxes would be a good sum."
"Not just a year," the Holy Father interjected.
In perpetuity.
In perpetuity? Kelsey repeated in an incredulous whisper. I could build my own damned Arvath with the money the Tierling would lose over 5 years alone.
You could build it, Majesty, but you don't have the time.
The Holy Father grinned, and for the first time his eyes showed a glimmer of light. But it wasn't a good sort of light at all.
The Mort will be here by autumn, and you're over a barrel. That's why we're having this conversation.
Don't make the mistake of thinking that you're anything more than a convenience to me, Your Holiness. I don't need your pile of gold.
Then don't make the mistake of thinking I'm frightened of your tax collector, Majesty. By the time the new year rolls around, you'll be in no position to tax anyone.
Kelsey had been thinking the same thing not 5 minutes before, but this fact only made her angrier. She turned fully toward him, no longer even pretending to take interest in the magic show. And what good is all that gold doing you, Your Holiness? Who is it you're trying to impress with that steeple of yours? God?
God is not interested in such trifles.
My point exactly?
Devout parishioners donated that gold, Majesty, as a matter of repentance and good works. Your uncle was one of them.
My uncle had 7 concubines and no marriage in sight. How devout could he be?
Your uncle confessed those sins to Father Timpani, Majesty, and was absolved.
A fascinating system. Children of 4 are subjected to more discipline. The Holy Father's voice tightened in anger.
You have criminal laws for secular punishment, Majesty. My concern is simply salvation of the soul.
But the gold helps, right?
How dare you!
Your Majesty. Bradshaw gave another elaborate bow at the foot of the dais. For my final trick, may I ask one of your guard to volunteer? Kelsey produced a wilted smile. Kib. Kib headed down the steps to the chuckles of the other guards, but Kelsey barely paid attention. Her hands were clenched tightly on the arms of her chair. It was all she could do not to throttle the man sitting next to her. All that room, she thought, staring at the Holy Father, her temples throbbing. All that room and all that gold. You don't use it, you don't need it, but it's not to be shared. If we live through the invasion, my friend, I am going to tax you until you scream for mercy. The Holy Father stared back at her with the supreme arrogance of one who had nothing to fear. Kelsey remembered a remark Mace had made weeks ago, that the Holy Father wasn't above dealing with Demain under the table. If the Holy Father had already made his deal, then of course he wouldn't be threatened by Kelsey. He need only sit and wait until the Mort army rolled in, sparing the Arvath and laying waste to everything else. And now Kelsey felt the first seeds of despair take root in her heart. She had spent the last month running back and forth, moving frantically from one option to the next, trying to find a solution. And now she looked up and found herself surrounded by cannibals.
In honour of your holy guests, Majesty.
Bradshaw produced the cup he'd used earlier and filled it with water from a small canteen, then handed it to Kib.
Have a sip, sir, and please confirm that it's water.
Kib sipped gently at the cup.
Water indeed.
The magician brought the cup to the front of the dais and held it up for Kelsey's inspection, waiting until she nodded to continue. With a small, polite bow to the Holy Father, Bradshaw covered the mouth of the cup with one hand and snapped the fingers of the other. A small flash of light appeared between his fingers, and then Bradshaw held the cup up to Kelsey again, removing his hand. The water in the goblet was now a deep, dark red.
"For Her Majesty's pleasure," Bradshaw announced. "Where's my able assistant?"
Kib raised his hand, and the magician danced over to him, holding out the cup.
"Taste it, sir. It will do you no harm."
Kib, smiling with a touch of anxiety, took a small sip from the cup. An astonished look came over his face, and he took a second, larger sip. Turning to Kelsey, he announced in an amazed voice,
"Majesty!" It's wine.
Kelsey chuckled, then giggled, and finally could not stop herself from roaring with laughter. She didn't miss the look of fury on the Holy Father's darkening face, but that only made her laugh harder. Below the dais, Bradshaw smiled, his face flushing with triumph.
Get up! Get up!
The shorter acolyte had fainted dead away, and the taller one was shaking him, hissing commands. But the young man was out cold. The Holy Father rose from his seat, his face a deep, rich red that pleased Kelsey no end. Father Tyler was murmuring gently in his ear, but the Holy Father shoved him away. He showed no concern for the unconscious boy on the floor.
"I see no humour in an insult offered to guests," the Holy Father snarled. "That was a blasphemous joke, Majesty, in poor taste."
"Don't look at me, Your Holiness. I don't keep court performers. His tricks are his own."
"I want an apology,"
he snapped. And Kelsey, who had assumed that this sort of ludicrous outrage was part of a Holy Father's job description, found herself hesitating, because his anger was clearly genuine. But even if Bradshaw had produced Mary the Virgin from a hat, no one could possibly take a magic trick seriously. The smart move was conciliation, but Kelsey was long past that now. She tapped her nails on the arm of the chair and asked sweetly, "An apology? From whom?"
"From his impostor, Majesty."
"Impostor? I'm quite sure he didn't mean to represent himself as the actual Christ, Your Holiness."
"I demand an apology." "Did you just give the Queen an order?"
Mace asked, his voice deadly soft.
"I certainly did."
"Refused," Kelsey snapped. "What kind of fool takes offence at an illusion?"
"Majesty, please."
Father Tyler had moved up to stand beside the Holy Father, his thin face blanched nearly white now. "This is hardly constructive."
"Shut up, Tyler,"
the Holy Father hissed.
"All magicians are charlatans. They promise quick solutions and undermine faith in the straight and righteous path."
Kelsey narrowed her eyes. "Don't even think about playing the devout card with me, Your Holiness. I've heard all about you. What are those two women you keep in the Arvath? Do they kneel down before the Holy Spirit every night?" At this, the Holy Father's face turned an apoplectic purple, and Kelsey suddenly wished that he would simply have a heart attack and keel over right in front of her throne, consequences be damned.
"Have a care, Majesty. You have no idea how delicate your position is."
"Threaten me again, you greedy fraud, and I will end you."
"I'm sure he meant nothing of the kind, Majesty,"
Father Tyler exclaimed in a high, panicky voice. "It was no threat, only..."
"Tyler, stay out of this,"
the Holy Father roared. He turned and lashed out with one arm, catching Father Tyler in the chest. Tyler momentarily pinwheeled for balance, then fell backward down the stairs of the dais. Kelsey heard the dry, crisp snap of a breaking bone, and all thought ceased, the voice of reason in her head falling mercifully silent. She jumped to her feet, pushed past Penn, and slapped the Holy Father across the face. Mace and Penn moved very quickly, and the rest of the guard were right behind them. Within a few seconds, more than 10 men stood between Kelsey and the Holy Father. The guards obscured her view, but not before she had seen and memorized the white mark of her handprint against the Holy Father's red cheek, wrapped it in her mind like a gift.
"Sacrilege!"
the taller acolyte hissed from the bottom of the stairs.
"No one can lay hands on the Holy Father."
"If you value that hypocrite, get him out of my keep right now." The acolyte scrambled up the steps to assist the Holy Father. Kelsey turned back to her armchair, determined to ignore them. But then she heard gasping breaths below her, behind the wall of guards. "Father, are you all right?"
"Fine, Majesty."
But Father Tyler's voice was hoarse with pain. "Stay there. We'll get you a doctor."
"Tyler will come with us,"
the Holy Father snarled. But Mace had already pushed his way down the steps and positioned himself between Father Tyler and the priests.
The Queen says he stays. My own doctors will attend him. I think not, Your Holiness. I've seen the work of your doctors.
The Holy Father's eyes widened, full of surprise, and something else. Guilt. Before Kelsey could decipher his reaction, Mace sprang across the room and laid hold of the taller acolyte, grabbing him by the neck.
We'll be keeping this one as well.
Brother Matthew, is it?
On what charge?
The Holy Father demanded, enraged.
Treason,
Mace announced flatly.
The Thorn Conspiracy.
The Holy Father's mouth worked for a moment.
We came here under promise of safe conduct.
I promised safe conduct to you, Your Holiness, Kelsey snapped, though inwardly she cursed Mace. He never told her anything. Now she placed Brother Matthew easily. One of the men from the Argive crouched around Thorn's campfire in the middle of the night. You're free to go, but your toadies came at their own risk.
I suggest you leave now,
Mace told the Holy Father, tightening his grip on the struggling priest's neck,
before I have a chance to ask your weasel any questions.
The Holy Father's eyes narrowed, and he kicked the shorter acolyte, who was still unconscious on the floor.
You, wake up. We're leaving.
Somehow or other, they got the young man to unsteady feet. Mace handed Brother Matthew off to Elston and followed the two Arvaf men to the doors. The second acolyte, his face white as milk, cast several appalled glances over his shoulder, but the Holy Father, walking stiffly at his side, never looked back. Kelsey hurried down the stairs to crouch beside Father Tyler, whose left leg was twisted at a dreadful angle. He was breathing in shallow pants, enormous beads of sweat rolling down his pale cheeks. Kelsey gathered the hem of her dress to wipe his forehead, but when Corin tried to examine the leg, Father Tyler groaned and begged him to stop.
Broken in multiple places, lady. We're going to have to put him out to reset the bone.
We'll wait for the doctor, Kelsey ordered, casting a murderous glance toward the Holy Father's retreating back. God's good work, I suppose. Father Tyler giggled, a wild, disconnected sound.
I got off light, Majesty. Seth will tell you so.
Who's Seth? But Father Tyler gritted his teeth, and although Kelsey asked her question several more times before the doctor arrived, he refused to answer. Chapter 5 Dorian. The success of a great human migration depends on many individual pieces falling into place. There must be discontent with an unpleasant, perhaps even intolerable, status quo. There must be idealism to drive the movement, a powerful vision of a better life beyond the horizon. There must be great courage in the face of terrible odds. But most of all, every migration needs its leader, the indispensable, charismatic figure whom even terrified men and women will follow headlong into the abyss. The British-American crossing met this final requirement in spades. The Blue Horizon of the Tear, Glee Delamere. Lily was sitting in the backyard, struggling to record a message to her mother. The day was too hot. Something must have gone wrong with the climate control. That happened more and more often lately. Greg said it was the separatists and their hackers sabotaging the satellites. The military men he dealt with at the Pentagon had been complaining about it for weeks. Over the past few days, the temperature in New Canaan had climbed into the high 90s, and now heavy, wet air blanketed the backyard. Weather aside, this had been a good week. Greg had gone on a business trip to Boston, some sort of convention with other players in the military. Lily always pictured these meetings as a larger version of the parties they held at their house. Drunken men, their voices growing louder and hoarser as more and more liquor poured forth. Still, she was grateful. When Greg was gone, she could almost pretend that this was her house, that she needed to count to no one for her day. There was no need to hide in the nursery. Lily could move freely around the house. But tonight, Greg would be coming home, and Lily was trying to snatch the last few hours to record her letter. It was hard to make her lies sound natural, particularly for Mom, who didn't want to hear about anything unpleasant. Lily had just hit record again when a woman toppled over the back wall into the garden. Lily looked up, startled. The woman rolled down the wall, a hissing sound following her descent as she scraped against the ivy that clung there. She ended up buried in the patch of hydrangea bushes, disappearing from sight with a low, wounded grunt. Jonathan materialized from the kitchen doorway, his gun drawn.
"Stay back, Mrs. M."
Lily ignored him, got up from her Adirondack, and tiptoed over to the stone wall. The intruder had flattened the hydrangea bush. Lily felt Jonathan's restraining hand on her arm, but she peered over the jagged edges of the bush until she found the woman who lay there. "She looks like Maddie." The woman did look remarkably like Lily's younger sister. Her hair, now tangled in the bush, hadn't been washed in some time, but it was the same dirty blonde, even the same springy texture. She had Maddie's snub nose, her freckles. She was a few years too young. Lily bit her lip, trying to remember how old her sister would have been now. 2 years younger than Lily, so 23. This girl couldn't be more than 18. Now Lily heard sirens, their wails muted by the thick stone wall. Security hardly ever used sirens in New Canaan. On the rare occasion when they came into Lily's neighborhood, it was a quiet, efficient business. But this woman clearly didn't belong in New Canaan. Her face was streaked with some kind of grease, and she wore jeans and a torn sweater that looked about 3 sizes too large. The edges of the sweater were bloody. Lily peered more closely, then drew back with a hiss. "She's been shot."
"Go on inside, Mrs. M. I'll call security."
The woman opened her eyes. They shone bright green and remarkably clear, too old for an adolescence, before they slipped closed again. The woman breathed in shallow pants, her hand clamped against the bloody patch on her stomach. She seemed too young to even contemplate crime, and she looked so much like Maddie. Maddie, who had disappeared years before. "You're injured," Lily told her. "You need a hospital."
"No hospital. She's a trespasser," Jonathan hissed.
The sirens were louder now, perhaps as close as Willow Street. The woman opened her eyes again, and in them Lily saw resignation, a tired sort of acceptance. Maddie had looked that way when they came for her, as if she were already imagining what came next. Lily didn't want to think about that day, about Maddie. Jonathan was right, they should call security. But Maddie was upon Lily now, and she found herself unable to do it, unable to turn the woman in. "Help me get her inside."
"What for?"
Jonathan asked. "Just help me."
"What would Mr. M say?"
Lily looked up at him, her voice sharpening. "It wouldn't be the first secret we've kept, would it?"
"This is different."
"Let's get her up."
"She's not a random wall trespasser, Mrs. M. You hear those sirens? You think they aren't for her?"
"Into the house. We'll put her in the nursery. He'll never know."
"She needs a doctor."
"Then we'll get her one."
"And then what? Doctors have to report gunshot wounds."
Lily hauled the woman up, slipping an arm under her shoulders, and wincing when the woman groaned. It seemed very important to hurry up and get the woman inside before she thought too hard about possible consequences. About Greg. "Come on, inside." Grumbling, Jonathan pitched in. Together they helped the woman across the garden and into the house, an air-cooled oasis of darkness. By the time they reached the living room, the woman had dropped into unconsciousness and become much heavier than her skinny frame would have suggested. Lily groaned as they hauled her through the foyer, but her mind was already clocking off the things she would have to do. First, the surveillance. Lily had no backup footage of the living room and stairway, but she could do a one-time erase, and Greg would chalk it up to a glitch. Probably, her mind amended. The separatists' shoes were covered with mud, and she had left several patches of it on the living room carpet. The house sterilized itself, but not that quickly. Lily would need to clean the mud up by hand before Greg came home. They muscled the injured woman into the nursery and deposited her on the sofa. Lily could feel Jonathan's glare even before she looked up.
"What are you doing, Mrs. M?"
"I don't know," Lily admitted. "I just..."
"What?"
A picture of security popped into Lily's head. The door through which they hustled people who never came out again. When Lily was a child, there hadn't been such doors. And even as she became an adult, she had paid very little attention to the world changing around her. She often thought that it was this very inattention to implications, to the future, that had allowed her to marry Greg in the first place. Maddie had been the political one, the one who cared about the wider world. Lily's immediate concerns were keeping the house running and dealing with Greg, finding ways to tiptoe around his newly volatile anger, to stay one step ahead of it. That was a full plate, certainly, but she couldn't escape a nagging sense of shared responsibility, of many good people, all of them with their eyes on the ground, who had allowed the faceless door of security to become the status quo. Maddie would not have allowed it, but Maddie had disappeared. Jonathan was still waiting for an answer, but Lily couldn't explain, not to him. Jonathan had been a Marine, had fought in Saudi Arabia in the final desperate battle for the last of the world's oil. He was a loyalist. He carried a gun. "I'm not going to turn her in," Lily finally replied. "Are you going to tell Greg?" Jonathan looked down at the woman on the sofa, his gaze contemplative.
"No, ma'am. But you need to get her to a doctor. If you don't, she's going to bleed to death right here on your couch."
Lily ran through the list of local doctors she knew. Greg's friends, none of them trustworthy. Their family doctor, Dr. Collins, had offices less than 5 miles away in the center of town. But he wasn't an option either. Dr. Collins had never asked Lily whether she wanted to have a baby. On her last visit, he told her that she needed to relax more during sex, that relaxing was a good way to conceive. "My purse. There's a card in there. My doctor in New York."
"Davis? This isn't his area. He's a fixer."
"He's a fertility specialist."
"Right, Mrs. M."
She stared at him for a moment. "Are you going to tell Greg?" Jonathan sighed, pulling the Lexus keys from his pocket.
"Stay here. Keep pressure on the wound. I'll be back with the doctor."
"What doctor?"
"Don't worry about it."
"Not one of Greg's friends?"
"Don't worry about it." "Mrs. M, you were right. We both know how to keep a secret."
Jonathan was gone for more than an hour, giving Lily plenty of time to imagine the worst. Jonathan arrested for transporting an unlicensed physician. Jonathan unable to find a doctor at all. But mostly, Jonathan gone straight to Greg's office, straight to security, to tell them everything. Jonathan had been her bodyguard for nearly 3 years, Lily told herself, and he knew about Dr. Davis. If he'd wanted to get her into trouble, he could have done so a long time ago. But still, she was afraid. The woman on the sofa was visibly dehydrating before Lily's eyes. Her lips were chapped nearly white, and when she tried to speak, it was a hoarse croak. Lily went downstairs and filled a bowl with chipped ice. She didn't know anything about taking care of sick people, but she'd had pneumonia when she was little, and for that entire week all she could stand to eat was ice chips. She wet her cloth with freezing water and dumped it into the bowl as well. When she returned, the woman on the sofa asked where she was. Lily tried to tell her, but the woman passed out again before she'd finished. Another 3 hours and Greg would be home. Where was Jonathan? What was Lily doing anyway?
The pills were one thing, one secret to keep. But hiding a person was something else.
What's your name? Lily asked the woman when she woke up again.
No names,
she whispered back.
Lily felt as though she had heard those words before, perhaps on one of the government's countless pamphlets and flyers. What had the woman been doing here?
From time to time, Lily heard sirens cruising the neighborhood, sometimes far away, and sometimes very close. She checked the news sites on the wall panel, but there was nothing. No local news about a trespasser or any nearby crime. She went out to the surveillance room and deleted that afternoon's footage. There was always a chance that Greg had seen it in real time, but that was very unlikely today. At the end of his conference, Greg would be busy glad-handing before he got on the plane. On her way back to the nursery, she cleaned up the mud. The woman was still unconscious. She was too young to be Maddie, yes, and a bit too tall as well. But still, it was almost like having a ghost on the sofa. As the afternoon advanced, the line of sun from the window moved across the woman's shoulder, and Lily spotted a scar there, just above the collarbone. Lily had a scar in the same place, a neat surgical line from having her tag implanted when she was young. This scar was much more noticeable. It was not the thin, pristine line that a laser would leave. It looked as though it had been done with a scalpel. Lily stared at the scar for a very long time, a wild idea taking hold in her mind. The woman had somehow removed her tag. That should have been impossible. Each tag was armed with a toxin, a deadly chemical that would release on impact if anyone tried to tamper with the device. But the longer Lily considered the scar, the more certain she became. This woman had managed to get rid of her tag. She could move freely wherever she wanted, without security tracking her every movement. Lily couldn't even imagine what that would be like. Jonathan finally came back at 4, with a small, neat, grey-haired man in tow. The little man looked just the way a doctor should look, to Lily's mind. He wore a professional-looking grey suit and old-fashioned wire-framed glasses, and he carried a small black leather bag that clinked as he set it down. He ignored Lily entirely, going straight to the woman on the sofa. After a moment's assessment, he turned, speaking as he would to a nurse.
"Boiling hot water and some towels, cotton towels."
For a moment, Lily was too surprised to move. She wasn't used to being ordered around in her own house.
Except by Greg, her mind whispered,
and that got her moving out of the nursery and down to the kitchen. After she had fetched the water, she went to the linen closet and tried to decide which towels Greg would miss the least. He had a strange, sporadic eye for details around the house. Lily would throw out a set of threadbare sheets, and then, a year later, Greg would ask where the sheets had gone. None of their towels were dark enough to hide blood. Whichever set she chose would have to be tossed.
Just pick and go, damn it.
Lily grabbed a set of pine green towels she'd always hated, a wedding gift from Greg's aunt. When she returned, she found that Jonathan and the doctor had moved the sofa into the direct sunlight beneath the windowsill. The doctor had removed the woman's oversized sweater to reveal a discolored man's undershirt beneath, and now he was cutting the undershirt off with some scissors he produced from his little bag. Lily bent down to deposit the towels beside him.
"That'll do, miss."
"Lily."
"No names."
That phrase again.
Feeling rebuked, Lily turned to Jonathan and found that he'd taken out his gun, a gleaming black thing that never failed to make Lily uneasy, and was fiddling with it, taking out the bullets and putting them in again.
"I need you to hold her down," the doctor said.
Lily didn't know who he was talking to, but both of them moved forward, Lily toward the woman's arms and Jonathan, tucking the gun away, toward her feet. Looking down, Lily saw a glint of panic in the woman's eyes, and she placed a hand on her forehead, feeling like the world's biggest fraud as she murmured,
"It'll be all right." The next half hour would stay with Lily in clear, sickening detail for the rest of her life. The doctor had a laser probe, at least, but when he began to poke around with it, the woman's arm strained until Lily's face and neck were slicked with sweat in the effort to hold her down. Every few minutes the doctor would mutter, "Buried deep, little bastard," and these mutterings were Lily's only way to mark the passage of time. She spent much of the operation staring at Jonathan, trying to puzzle him out. He was a good bodyguard and a gifted driver. But he was also a former Marine, and, Lily had always thought, a loyalist. How on earth did he know an off-the-grid doctor? How would either of them be able to keep this from Greg? The doctor finally found the bullet, then began to work a small set of tongs into the hole. The woman passed out again, somewhere in the middle of this process, her arms going mercifully slack against Lily's hands. The temperature in the nursery felt as though it had climbed sharply, though the wall panel only read 74 degrees. Lily was dizzy, as though she'd lost all the blood in her head. Jonathan, no surprise, was steady as ever, his face immobile as he watched the doctor work. He'd probably killed men in Saudi Arabia with the same stone face. At last the doctor held up the tongs to display a deformed piece of scarlet dripping plastic. Jonathan held out a towel, and the doctor dropped the bullet into it, making the cotton bloom red, then began to seal the wound.
"Was she successful?" the doctor asked. "I don't know," Jonathan replied. "One of us should let him know she's here." "I'll do it. How long will she have to stay?" "Ideally, she needs a few days' rest. She's lost a lot of blood. There's no way to get her out anyway, not until she can walk. I would think there are roadblocks up by now."
The doctor gave Lily a doubtful look.
"But can she stay here?"
"Yes, she can," Lily replied, trying to sound firm. But the rest of the conversation had mystified her. What kind of doctor patched wounds and asked no questions? The doctor wiped his hands on one of Lily's bath sheets, then threw it on her armchair.
"She'll need fairly constant care."
"I'll do it," Lily volunteered. "During the day I can be in here all the time. At night, maybe every few hours."
"What does a woman like you want with something like this?"
Lily flushed at the judgment she saw in his eyes. Her nursery was bigger than most people's homes. She wished she could tell this neat little man about Maddie, but she didn't know where to begin. "I just do. She'll be safe here." The doctor considered her for another moment, then opened his bag and dumped a pile of medical paraphernalia onto the sofa. Bandages, syringes, pill bottles.
"You'll need to change the bandage at least once a day. If she becomes feverish, give her this. Have you ever given someone an injection?"
"Yes." Lily nodded vigorously, feeling more confident now. The new syringes had guides to pinpoint veins, but even if the doctor's syringes were the older kind, Maddie had been a diabetic. Lily knew how to give a shot. The doctor held up a green-wrapped syringe.
"Antibiotics. Give her an injection every evening at the same time. The vein in her forearm."
He turned back to Jonathan.
"She can stay here for a few days, but she could easily develop infection. The sooner he gets her out, the better."
"He who?" Lily wondered now. The doctor's voice was so reverent that for a moment Lily thought he was talking about God.
"I need to take the doctor back, Mrs. M., then run some errands. I might be gone until late."
Lily nodded slowly. "I'll tell Greg you went to pick up my new dress in the city." This wasn't precisely a lie. Lily had ordered a new dress from Chanel several weeks ago. $15,000, amethyst silk with hand-sewn sequins. Now, looking down at the unconscious woman on the sofa, she felt sick.
"We need to go. Her husband will be home soon."
The doctor gathered up his instruments, wiped them down with a bloody towel, and stuck them inside his bag.
"These towels need to be burned. You can't just throw them away."
"I know that," Lily snapped, glaring at him. Then she looked down in bewilderment. The floor tiles had begun to tremble beneath her feet. A giant thunderclap echoed outside, an explosion of noise that made Lily cover her ears. Dimly, from the other end of the house, she heard glass shatter. The doctor had covered his ears as well, but Jonathan merely stood staring out the window, a faint smile on his face. For a few seconds, the walls and doors continued to rattle, and then they were still.
The security alarm went off downtown, its distinctive bray loud enough to penetrate even the unconscious brain of the woman on the couch. She rolled and murmured in her sleep.
The doctor reached out to clasp Jonathan's hand.
"The better world. The better world," Jonathan repeated.
Lily stared at him with wide eyes, 100 tiny things coming together in her mind. Jonathan's encyclopedic knowledge of the public roadways, his inexplicable decision to keep Lily's secrets, his mysterious nighttime errands. Now Lily understood why the injured woman had rolled over the wall into this particular garden. Because Jonathan was here. Jonathan, a separatist.
"I'll be back later, Mrs. M."
She nodded, watching him go. Deep down, she secretly hoped that the doctor would shake her hand as well. But he didn't, only gave her another distrustful look as he went. Lily was left staring at the woman on the couch, her mind already categorizing the various types of trouble she was in. If she were caught harboring a fugitive, she would be arrested, taken into custody. But even the dangers of arrest paled against what would happen if Greg found out. Greg called the separatists filth. He crowed whenever one of them was caught, and watched with a grim but smug pleasure as they were executed on the government site. "I need to be smart now," Lily thought, staring at the woman on the couch. She wondered how it was possible to be terrified and at the same time deeply excited. She had gone to a party one weekend in high school, years before she had met Greg. She had been drunk, yes, but not so drunk that she didn't know what she was doing. And at the end of the night, she had followed a boy into a darkened room and given up her virginity. Just like that. Lily had never learned the boy's name, not even in the morning. But he had been shy and kind, and she had never regretted the incident. A moment of wild abandon that had seemed, in that time and place, to define her. "I'm here," she thought now, terrified but buoyant, as though she were floating in midair at a great height. "Really and truly here." It had been a long time. When Greg walked through the door, Lily could already tell that it was going to be a bad night. His head was lowered like a bull's, and there were sweat stains under his arms. Although he'd never said so, Lily was fairly sure he was scared of flying. She could smell him all the way across the living room, a mixture of bitter fear sweat, and the sandalwood cologne he wore every day. The cologne smelled like a dead animal. "If he'd only been wearing it when I met him," Lily thought, biting her cheek against the sudden peal of awful laughter, "maybe I would have told him to get lost." She had taken a shower, straightened her hair, and put on her best dress, knowing that Greg would come home angry. The news sites had begun to carry the story almost immediately. 3 East Coast security bases, one only 6 miles from New Canaan, had suffered some sort of cataclysmic chemical explosions in their jet proving grounds. The casualties had been low. The terrorists had clearly been aiming for equipment, not men, and they had succeeded. More than 100 jets had been destroyed. 2 civilian contractors from Lockheed had died as well, but they hadn't been workers, only management. Only management. That sounded like something Lily's father would have said. Dad had been a chemical engineer, and by the end of his life, he'd been management himself, making upward of $5 million a year. But his sympathies had always been with the workers. When Lily was very young, Dad even tried to organize a union at Dow. But that attempt had died with Frewell's Labour Facilitation Act. When quality control went to complete automation a few years later, there weren't even any workers to unionize anymore. Dad was well off, yes, but Lily knew he was unhappy. He had died 2 years ago, and even in those last hours, sitting beside his bed in the hospital, Lily could sense him longing, still dreaming of his more equitable world. She couldn't escape the feeling that she was the wrong daughter to be there, that it was Maddie he really wanted. Greg dumped his coat on the sofa and went straight for the bar. Another bad sign. Lily noted the hunch of Greg's thick shoulders beneath his suit, the way his dark brows had knitted together over his fraternity handsome face, the clench of his jaw as he dumped gin into a glass. Liquid sloshed over the rim onto the bar, but Greg didn't wipe it away. That would be her job, Lily thought, and was surprised to feel a dim throb of anger trying to break through her anxiety. The anger struggled briefly, then drowned. Security sirens had been sounding in and out of their neighborhood all afternoon. They hadn't come to Lily's door, but they had gone to see Andrea Torres down the block. On the rare occasions when something happened in New Canaan, Andrea was always the first one questioned, because her husband was half Mexican and had once been arrested on suspicion of helping illegal immigrants cross state lines. But Andrea was a tiny, shy woman who could barely gather the courage to go down and get her own mail at the foot of her lawn. Lily always invited her to parties as a matter of form, since they lived in the same neighborhood. But Andrea never came. Security was looking for an 18-year-old woman, 5'6", with blonde hair and green eyes. She had been hired as a civilian cleaner at Pryor Security Base 3 months ago, and today, somehow, she had made her way onto the jet fields and planted a bomb. She had taken gunfire as she fled from the scene, and they believed she was wounded. Her name was Angela West. No names, Lily had thought almost reflexively. The woman in the nursery was not an Angela. Lily decided that she must have been mistaken about the scar on the woman's shoulder. No one would have been able to get security clearance on a military base without a tag. The news site said that the woman had known affiliations with the Blue Horizon, but no one seemed able to explain what domestic terrorists wanted with jets designed for transcontinental flight. The sites postulated that the separatists were mad dogs, simply going after the nearest military installation. Everyone knew they were headquartered in New England somewhere, although neither security nor private bounty hunters had been able to find a trace. The news said that naval bases were a convenient target. Even to Lily, this explanation didn't ring quite true. Every few months, Greg would invite a security lieutenant named Arnie Welch over to dinner, and the last time, after a few drinks, Arnie had admitted mournfully that the Blue Horizon were efficient, well-organized terrorists. They targeted carefully selected goals and usually succeeded. Lily watched the online news because there was nothing else, but she knew the news sites were heavily censored. Security was determined to keep the size of the problem under wraps, but Arnie could always be persuaded to talk on his third glass, and according to Arnie, the Blue Horizon was a much bigger problem than most civilians knew.
"You haven't asked me about my day."
Lily looked up and found Greg staring at her, a hint of petulance in his protruding lower lip. She got up from the armchair, taking a deep breath, and went and kissed him. He tasted like salami and olives. He'd already been drinking martinis on the plane. "I'm sorry."
"I had a bad day," he told her, pouring himself a scotch.
Lily nodded with what she hoped looked like sympathy. Every day was a bad day for Greg. "Did the trip go all right?"
"It did, right until terrorists blew up every jet on the East Coast."
"I saw it on the news."
Greg looked down at her, irritated.
And Lily realized that he had wanted to tell her about it himself.
I didn't know it was terrorists. I thought they were just accidents. Explosions.
They weren't. Three saboteurs got security clearances. One of them was even a woman. I don't know what the hell has happened to this country.
Greg took a swig of whiskey.
I have to go down to Washington in a couple of hours. The Pentagon will need more jets in a hurry, and they're going to want me to take care of it.
That's good, Lily replied tentatively.
No, it isn't, he snapped. The fucking separatists have bombed damn near every jet production facility on the East Coast over the past 2 years. Only two of them are still up and running. The rest are still being repaired. There's no way for us to come up with even a fraction of the jets the Pentagon is going to ask for. Every time we build something, the Blue Horizon blows it up.
Lily wanted to ask questions about the woman, to see if Greg had more information. But she knew better. She'd seen Greg like this several times in the past year, and they always came with injuries. Two black eyes and a night in the emergency room with a broken arm. The last time had been the worst. Greg had wanted to have sex almost as soon as he came in the door. And when Lily pushed him away, he'd slapped her. While he was fucking her, he had bitten her shoulder hard enough to draw blood. Lily shook off the memory, a quick, reflexive mental movement almost akin to a shiver. Greg always said he was sorry afterward, and there was usually a present of some kind attached, earrings or a dress. There was nothing to do but forget these things, until they happened again.
Now I'll have to go down to Washington and stand in front of 10 3-star and higher generals and explain that what they want can't be done.
Lily tried for empathy, but none was forthcoming. In fact, she realized in astonishment, she almost wished Greg would hit her, as he plainly meant to at some point, and leave. She wanted to be back in the nursery. It had been nearly an hour, and the woman would be thirsty.
"What was her name?"
Lily asked.
"Huh?"
Greg had begun stroking the crack of her ass, something she hated. She willed herself to be still, not to brush his hand away.
"The terrorist. The woman. What was her real name? Did they find out?"
"Dorian Rice. She escaped from the Bronx Woman's Correctional a year ago. You believe that?"
Lily did.
I've just enough time for dinner before I leave.
Lily knew her role now. She was supposed to serve dinner, then ask if he wanted anything, if there was anything she could do for him. She sensed Greg waiting for her to ask. He knew this routine as well as she did. And yet, Lily found herself unable to act.
If he decides he wants to screw, I'll go out of my fucking mind.
Greg's hand had stopped stroking her crack, a small favour that suddenly seemed worth whatever might happen next. Lily slipped out of his arms.
"I'll go get you some food."
He grabbed her arm before she'd taken 2 steps toward the kitchen, his hand clamping hard.
"What are you thinking about?"
"You."
Lily wondered if Dorian Rice would be hungry, if she could eat solid food. She should have asked the doctor.
"No, you're not,"
Greg replied, his voice petulant.
"You're thinking about something else. I don't like it when you do that."
"Do what?"
"I don't like it when you go somewhere else in your head. You're supposed to be here with me."
"You fucking candy ass."
Lily bit down on the words, bit down hard. "Candy ass." It was Maddie's favourite insult. She'd applied it to at least half the people in media by the time she was 14.
"Why don't you say you love me? I've had a lousy day."
Lily opened her mouth, even found her lips edging into an oval to shape the words.
"I can't say it."
"But what if he hits you?"
"Well, what if he fucking well does?"
That was Maddie again. She and her perennially foul mouth seemed to have taken up residence in Lily's head. Greg's hand had coiled in her hair, and he yanked her head backward, not hard enough to be truly painful, but enough for a warning. Lily felt a muscle pop in her neck.
"Everything I do for you, Lil. Don't you love me?"